Our Valentine's Day sale is here, and through Valentine's Day, you can pick up any of my full-length online courses for 25% off with the code LOVE. This includes my new Sex Worth Wanting course, a course for couples to help you create a more passionate, intimate, and joyful marriage. We won't have another site-wide sale like this until Black Friday, so don't spend another year hoping for change. Get started creating it today. Again, that's 25% off all my full-length online courses using the code LOVE. When we take the risk to love with our whole heart, to bring our full self without the guarantee of reciprocation, but that we choose to love as fully as we can, it's scary. There is risk, but we create a freer space and we create a marriage that feels alive.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Jennifer, what a pleasure it is to have you on the podcast today. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Emily and I have been reading your new book. It is absolutely fantastic. And I can't think of a better title for it, that you might have joy. Because it's this theme throughout the whole book about real joy that we can experience, especially with those with a good Christian background and reconciling with sexuality. So,
yeah, great. Yeah.
Sure, it's a labor of love.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a short book and, you know, to be written in a few months. And then it turned into a much longer book and took 4 years. But I don't regret any of that. It was also me sorting out my mind a little more on the subject. So it was time well spent for me anyway.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we've greatly benefited. And I hope everyone listening to this episode will buy your book. And I'm sure they will be benefited too. But today I want to zoom in on one aspect of the book. And that is male sexuality. I think it would be very fitting to talk about. And you share a story about a man named Samuel. He's very scrupulous. Can you relate that story? And I think that'll frame our discussion today.
Yeah. So Samuel is somebody who's in his early 30s and growing up as a Latter-day Saint, but very, very religious, really took seriously the idea that sexual sin interferes with spirituality. And he took the teachings that he got very literally, like to do nothing that would arouse feelings in his body. And because he had scrupulosity, which is a form of OCD, he quite literally obeyed the letter of the law and wouldn't even touch himself to wash. You know, he took it to an extreme. He didn't date because when he would date women or get near women, he would feel sexual feelings. And he felt quite literally like he was undermining his spiritual well-being, his, you know, safety in a certain sense. You know, of course, most religious people don't interpret the sexual expectations of chastity in such an extreme form. But I brought up this story because we often think that if we are literally rejecting this part of ourselves, we will be more spiritual, that we will be blessed for that, when that in fact isn't true, you know, because here he was in his 30s, a very intelligent guy. Who was living in his parents' basement, essentially, because he couldn't tolerate the adult experience of integrating his sexuality, of coming to peace with his sexuality. So because he wasn't at peace in his own skin, he couldn't create anything intimate or meaningful with a partner. And so he quite literally stayed kind of stuck in his development in an effort to be good. And so I use his story as basically the argument that sexual repression is not our goal. Sexual integration is our goal.
Right.
And what I mean by sexual integration is that we have to come to a place of acceptance of our embodiment, that God gave us bodies, God gave us sexuality. And there are some things in life you can just say no to, and you're better for saying no to them. Never touch them, never deal with them. But the sensuality of the body is not something. we can't escape it, even the pleasures of food, right?
Right.
So the fact that the body is sensual and capable of pleasure, it means we have to sort out a way to be in relationship to pleasure, mm-hmm. whether it's the pleasures of sex or touch or food, in a way that accrues to our strength and doesn't undermine our morality. So to integrate our sexuality is to accept our sexual embodied nature, which is a process. That's not just something you just do one day, but coming to peace with the fact of your humanity, your embodied, imperfect humanity, but also making choices in line with our morality, that we are living in a way that makes our lives stronger, makes our relationships stronger, that the pleasures accrue to our joy, not to an indulgent escape or in some way undermining our lives. So I use the story of Samuel to really, he's a more extreme story, although I think many, many people relate to that mm-hmm. story. But I think he's very, very rigid in his interpretation. But it's pointing out that living that law perfectly does not make us stronger.
Right.
And so we must, in a sense, we need another way to think about what the moral project is that we're up to.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I used to think that spirituality and sexuality were at odds with each other. And mm-hmm. when I'd have a sexual thought or something, I would think, oh no, that's a sin. So I'd try mm-hmm. to combat that with more spirituality, thinking, more spirituality
exactly.
will squash the sexuality.
Right.
Like one's the angel and one's the devil.
Exactly. Concept. Exactly. Yes.
And it doesn't work out very well.
No, no, it doesn't. Yeah. And exactly. And I tell another story in another section of the book about someone who really did that. Like he kept looking at porn. So then he would try to go do the religious practices that he thought would quell this part of him. And, you know, I make the point that repression drives obsession. So we actually end up thinking about sexuality much, much more when we're so afraid of it and don't know what to do with it and fear that it's going to interfere with our spiritual well-being, mm-hmm. that we actually paradoxically end up having, we're thinking about sex all the time, in a sense, trying to not think about it. And or we succeed in repressing it, and then it actually still wreaks havoc on our lives because we then are in a relationship in which we don't know how to bring our sexuality or we are afraid of it. So we don't really have the option in full suppression.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if we won't deal with our sexuality, it deals with us.
Right. Yeah. Emily and I were talking last night about the things we're reading and I related to a little bit of like, well, I kind of want to be sexual, but I don't want to be too sexual. So I got to like pretend I'm not really interested in sex. I got to do these other things.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden I operate as if sex is icing rather than the cake of a marriage.
Yeah.
And then I try to replace, you know, what ought to be the cake with all these other things that never quite really fill or fulfill.
Yeah.
And it kind of creates a little emptiness or a little hollowness in the marriage.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an understandable challenge because so many of us have been taught to think of sexuality and the body as Satan's pathway.
Uh-huh.
And so because we are starting with that idea, then we're not sure how to relate to it. You know, like how much is too much and what does that actually mean? And is it okay to have these thoughts or not? And is it okay to have them in marriage? Like we learn that it's okay, but like, when is it not okay? And I'm... You know, so they're fair questions because I think when we're not sure it's a good thing, then we don't know how much is too much.
Right.
And I think a better way to think about it is sex is neither good nor bad. It is based on what we are creating through it.
Yes.
That is, are we relating to our sexuality and pleasure in a way that accrues to our strength, that makes a marriage stronger? Mm-hmm. Are we learning how to love and be loved through it? Are we working out a real partnership? Like those are all the questions, but the cake, to use that idea, is that attraction is the cake of a marriage. And I don't mean that people can't go through wax and waning of attraction and so on, but mm-hmm. this idea that you are special to me, that I want to be close to you, that I don't want you to be close to others in this way, that's a kind of meaning that sits at the foundation of a marriage. that's not the same thing as everybody should be having sex three times a week or whatever. So I don't mean it in the quite literal way right. that some people may think about what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this idea of you are special, I'm drawn to you, I'm sharing my sexuality with you and only you. That's a meaning that is the birthplace of the marriage and something that when it's not, when it doesn't stay alive in the marriage for whatever reason, often good reasons, that it undermines the peace in the marriage.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I want to go back to something you said a moment ago. If sex isn't Satan's playground, what is Satan's playground then?
Yeah. So I do make an argument throughout the book that Satan's playground is ego.
Mm-hmm.
It's our desire for reinforcement, our desire for the world to yield to our impulses, our demands. It's fear, it's control, it's rigidity. And
it's deceit, it's lying.
It's deception.
Uh-huh, right.
It's deception. And it's, you know, we lie because we want to be seen in positive ways while reinforcing or controlling what we get access to within ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so the opposite of that, and I call that the Thanatos pull within us, is Eros. And Eros is the desire to reach beyond ourselves,
right,
towards another soul, towards divinity, towards goodness in the world. It's that expansive desire. And when sex is about Eros, and sex can be about Thanatos, so sex can be about control and despair and futility. But if sex is about Eros, this is, I want to know you,
mm-hmm,
that it's you I accept, it's you that I love, it's you I want to be close to and commune with. That's the erotic energy, the life-giving energy, the lifeblood of a marriage. And so we must not confuse evil with the body,
uh-huh,
because the body is in fact a spiritual instrument,
right,
and it's a gift. It's a spiritual gift, uh-huh, but we can often relate to the body in ways that are, you know, the Thanatos pull, that sort of sense of self reinforcement and control. So it's how are we relating to the body that matters. And so, yeah, deception is a powerful form of ego.
Yeah. And one thing about deception and ego there is sometimes we're so good at deceiving ourselves, we don't know we're doing it. Like consider the case,
yeah,
of like a husband
100%.
And wife where he is more open to sexual novelty, has a wider range of things, and
yes,
wife isn't. And then he uses things like in the name of love or in the name of whatever. Like,
yeah,
you need to do these things with me, like the Bradley and Andrea story. Can you talk,
yes,
about that for a little bit? That kind of a pseudonym?
Yeah. So, of course, these are all pseudonyms. But you're, in case somebody's like, "Hey, I know a Bradley and Andrea," I bet it's them.
I'm just glad you didn't have a Dan and Emily in your book. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Bradley is a person in the book who is very high desire and very demanding around sex. So he's always pressuring his wife to do things that he wants, even when he knows she doesn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he pressures her enough and she relents, he knows that she's not into it, that she's not really that happy, but he proceeds anyway because she did say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So he would use that idea.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that she wasn't enjoying herself, didn't really want to be there, and was going forward anyway because he would insist, well, this is how I feel closer to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true on some level that he felt less panic and despair, but he would always sell the idea or try to sell the idea that he didn't have the sexual issues that Andrea had.
Right.
And
because from his point of view, she's the bottleneck.
She's the low desire person.
Right.
Yeah. She's the bottleneck.
She's the broken,
right? She's
one.
The one who's,
yeah,
she's the one that's saying no. Obviously, she's got the hangups.
Uh-huh.
Now, she would acknowledge, you know, yeah, I do have some sexual hangups, and I certainly don't like the sex we're having.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm the problem. I mean, I think that was an easy thing for her to believe and almost prefer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if she were to talk more honestly to him about what she saw as so undesirable about the sex he was offering, he would tend to get angry and frustrated and critical of her. So she kind of preferred the idea that maybe if I could just find some way to want this bad sex, we would be okay. Mm-hmm. In my work with him, he mentioned that he felt this sense that God rejected him, mm-hmm. that God was disgusted with him, I think he even said. Uh-huh. And I asked him to write out a dialogue with God. And this is something I do sometimes with clients, is to get a better sense of how they're carrying a relationship in their mind. And so he wrote out a conversation he was having with God about his sexuality. Mm-hmm. And what was so striking is that while he was totally into novelty, which, just to be clear, is not about sexual advancement. I mean, a lot of men talk like they're ahead of their wives, but that's just a function of testosterone. And I'm not trying to dismiss what men want at all, uh-huh. but don't confuse it with being further ahead.
Right.
It's more that you want something and your wife wants something. And sorting out how to build a bridge, an honest bridge, is really the way to have something you both desire. And Bradley, always talking about all the things he wanted, looked like he had no issues. But when I read this conversation he was having with God, a theoretical conversation, the God in his mind fully rejected him, thought his sexuality was disgusting, right? And he was like a child trying to get favor, trying to get acceptance from a God that he thought couldn't possibly accept him. And that was very illuminating for me and for him to see that, if anything, he accepted his sexuality even less than Andrea did. And that this was very much, you know, the God in his mind was very similar to his actual father, who was a kind of contemptuous and rejecting person. And so I use that story to just help people understand that high desire versus low desire is not necessarily a function of sexual integration, right? That is, it really depends on, are you truly at peace? And are you truly able to let yourself be known in this way and to really know another person in this way, right? And how they may be different than you and want different things. You know, Bradley had no interest in understanding Andrea, because if he were to understand her, he would better understand why she did not want to have sex with him. Because it wasn't desirable sex. It was demanding. It was pressuring. It was disconnected from her. And he was so afraid to see that, because he already felt so unworthy, and he just wanted the validation of her acceptance, of her saying yes, and the sense of control that would come from that. And so he had no interest in intimacy, no capacity for it, because he was himself so tortured inside.
Gotcha. I like that, because it illustrates that when we're not integrated sexually, sex isn't intimate. It can't be intimate.
Are you looking for a meaningful Valentine's Day gift? Give the gift of time with your spouse by committing to working together through my new book, That We Might Have Joy. Starting on February 19th, I'm going to be offering a book club. You'll meet with me each week for a deep dive into the concepts that are taught in That We Might Have Joy. And I'll use your questions that you submit to guide immersive discussions, helping you to see more clearly how the teachings in the book can apply to you and your relationship. The cost is $59 per household and is essentially 5 dates. Whether you've already read the book or have been meaning to get around to it, this is a wonderful opportunity to engage with the material in a whole new way together. So join us and experience how the insights of That We Might Have Joy can reshape the way you see yourself, your relationships, faith, and joy. You can order your copy and learn more about the book club by clicking on the link in the show notes.
How about a lot of the young men? I put myself in this camp, you know, raised in our modern conservative culture. Not to blame the culture, there's a lot of good aspects of it too, but just the idea that when we're not integrated sexually, it does interfere with our ability to have intimate sex. Maybe because it's not moral, yes. or because we don't have that idea in our mind. It's more like a transaction or something you try to get.
Yes. Yeah, exchanging favors, exchanging pleasure. It's more role-based, or this is what we should do as a couple. And I'm not dismissing that that can't be reassuring for people. But I think the more that we develop and grow and come to peace with ourselves, the more intimate our marriage can be and the more intimate our sexual relationship can be, because we're able to show up there. We're able to be at peace in our own skin and be with our partner. I mean, I think it shocked me somewhat in the beginning when I started working with couples to realize that sex wasn't necessarily making people feel closer. That in fact, sometimes people would get through the act of sex and feel desperately lonely afterwards, like not known, not free to be themselves, having to manage something, how much they showed up, having to manage their spouse's feelings or response to them. A lot of negotiating without words, the level of contact in the couple. And that because there was often a lot of turmoil, both either within one of or both people or between them, you know, that was showing up and infecting the sexual connection and infecting how open-hearted and free and peaceful and joyful it could be. So our development as individuals, meaning our ability to be at peace with ourselves, to have compassion towards ourselves, to make choices we are genuinely at peace with around our sexuality and in our lives in general, all of that deeply shapes how much we want to let somebody in on who we are and how much we can know another person. Because if we need them to reinforce us, just like Bradley with Andrea, we can't know them. We don't want to know them. We don't want to know what they really think.
Yeah.
Right.
So there needs to be that first step of maybe self-intimacy, I guess, peace with ourselves.
Yeah. And it's maybe easy to say peace with yourself because, you know, the way that you build more honest peace with yourself is often seeing yourself through your partner's eyes. I mean, for Bradley, it was seeing that, first of all, he's kind of a mess inside around his sexuality while pretending to be, you know, the most informed person in the bedroom anyway. And then also getting more clear about how hard it was for his wife to be open to him because he was a bundle of anxiety and demandingness. And even if they had sex, she didn't want to be very available to it. Right. And again, this is a more extreme story. But we do this in very subtle ways where we're negotiating meanings in sex that we can't yet really acknowledge to ourselves or to our partner because we're afraid of the outcome. We're afraid of them being disappointed in us. We're afraid that they will reject us, whatever it is. But intimacy is a tough business. So yes, it requires peace with ourselves, but it's not like first peace with yourself, then peace in your marriage. Sometimes the way to get to peace in the marriage is that the marriage itself will reveal what you have to deal with in yourself.
Got it. So when couples are negotiating these meanings in the bedroom, what does that mean? How does that come about?
So one of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, to quote Socrates, the body is an instrument of perception, right? That is to say, the body is a spiritual instrument. It's something we are able to map meanings at a much higher level than what we can communicate verbally. So like even as a baby, you're mapping your mother's face. You're like, are they delighted in me? Do they love me? You know, you're tracking it all at the level of the body. And so this is especially true in sex. And you can map a lot about your partner's mind in the way that they touch you or don't touch you, the way they connect with you or don't, right? So we are negotiating these unspoken meanings all the time, and they deeply impact how our bodies respond. It reminds me of a couple that I worked with years ago where there had been some breaches in the marriage on his side. There had been trouble in the marriage. She was also somebody that was deeply challenged around the body and sexuality. She had a lot of anxieties that she was bringing into this. And they had both been handling their fears in ways that were driving a deeper wedge. They started working with me and they both were doing the hard work of self-confronting. It had been like a year since they'd had sex, but they were really working on the question of who they were, bringing more honesty to that question and that conversation. I remember that there was one night where she came and told this story at the next session, but that she had been just lying in bed. There had been a lot of good things happening between them. Mm-hmm. And she was lying in bed with her back to her husband. And he saw her there and was just feeling so much gratitude for her. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking about that, like that he was really grateful for the changes that were happening between them, for the level of conversations they were starting to have. And he was thinking how beautiful she was. And he just started to touch her back while thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, I would normally, if he had put his hands on, I would recoil. Like I would think, is he trying to initiate sex? Is this what he wants? You know, I don't trust him. But you know, she was, And she said it was so strange. But like when he touched me this time, it's like I knew that he wasn't trying to get anything. And she said, I felt beautiful. And then I can't remember at what point it became clear that that is exactly what he had been thinking. Uh-huh. And feeling about her, if it was in the session or if it was a conversation they had. But it just illustrated for me the power of how we're mapping each other through touch all the time. You know, you can even track this in your own marriage, anybody listening, that how much the way your spouse touches you, how much it's saying to you. Is it like a pat, like don't want anything more? I'm just like trying to like get through this. Uh-huh. Are you leaning in? Uh-huh. Right? Is there a kind of surrender in the kiss? Uh-huh. Is it, you know, there's just so much that we are tracking and understanding.
Yeah.
And sometimes it helps to bring those meanings up to surface level where you can actually look at them and think about them, to think about how you are engaging in your marriage. And maybe you can, you know, sometimes people initiate, but it's like a grab. They're trying to get something rather than, you know, a deeper validation of their partner. So, yeah.
That is so good. All right. So healthy integration with our sexuality. I have a friend who told me that he and his wife went skinny dipping at a private lake, no one around. But for them, it was a mark of like, because for years, they're afraid of being sexual. He was kind of ashamed that he wanted his wife so much and that
they
could do this and relax and just really enjoy each other in this way.
Yeah.
To him, it was like, we have come such a long way. And their marriage from the outside in, at least, just full of this Eros energy.
Exactly. Because, you know, our sexuality wants to be free. Eros is about freedom and choosing and agency and self-definition. Mm-hmm. And so Eros has risk in it because it's stepping outside of what we already have control over whenever we're in Eros energy. And so it's the creative part of us. It's the yearning part of us. It's the part of us that wants to transcend our lesser selves. Mm-hmm. But that means there's always risk. There's certainly risk to the ego. You know, you may not get what you want. You may have to face disappointment, right?
Right.
But when we don't let our fear control us and instead we follow the soul's longing, we forge more capacity and we forge more freedom and agency in our lives by choosing in line with who we truly are. So when we do that in a marriage, take the risk to love with our whole heart, to bring our full self without the guarantee of reciprocation, but that we choose to love as fully as we can. It's scary. There is risk, but we create a freer space and we create a marriage that feels alive. And so when couples have that energy, they're more beautiful. It doesn't matter how old they are. They're beaming with energy. There's a magnetism in them and in their marriages. And it's not about the quantity of sex or anything per se. It's more about the energy that resides between them. There is an honesty, an open-heartedness. There is a deep acceptance. There's something honest and real. And they bring their full selves to that marriage. And so, you know, that takes courage.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't tend to think of marriage as asking for courage. But it does. A lot of us get married and then try to run it from the worst in ourselves and from our control rather than from our desire to create something beautiful there.
Yeah. Any last stories to like put a bow on this to illustrate that very thing? A couple that's really moved into that you know, they have that Eros energy alive in them.
I mean, I would just say that I sometimes do 10-day retreats with couples where I'm teaching a few hours a day and then they're out doing different experiences. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's interesting because I get to watch people over 10 days. And I don't mean I'm watching them. I'm just like, you know, I'm interacting and seeing them. And you watch the couples where they're self-confronting. They're having some hard conversations. Usually by day three, people look pretty bad. Like they don't look that happy. They're dealing with some tough topics and things between them often. But if couples stay in it and so on, and they keep self-confronting, you know, moving into more acknowledgement that I can see that problem, I can see my part in that problem, they start to, there's like a rebirth that's happening. There's a change of heart. There's a transition in their countenance. You can feel it. Mm-hmm. You can see it. They look like they got, you know, a facial.
Uh-huh. They look just younger. Admit, they're radiating.
They really do. They're radiating uh-huh. more energy and more joy. Absolutely. More joy. And so it is often a change of heart, a change of perspective that is life-giving and life-giving to the marriage.
Yeah. As I like to say, it's like the grass is greener, the sky is bluer.
Yeah.
Everything's like, there's a pep in your step.
More alive.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Good. Great. Now, you've written this fantastic book, and to accompany the book, you've developed a new course called Sex Before Haunting.
Yes. Plug
that real quick before we end.
Yeah. Yeah. So Sex Worth Wanting is really based on the book and just the things that I've learned about it. But it's speaking to how do you really cultivate a sexual relationship that two people understandably want, right? That's not just about having more sex or better sex, but how do you actually cultivate something that has a real soul in it? You know, there is a spirituality to this, but it doesn't sell well. People are like, what does that have to do with sex?
Right, right.
Uh-huh. I mean the spirituality of joy.
Yes.
Of feeling like I'm talking about, that sense of aliveness.
Connectedness.
That sense of deeper connection, mm-hmm. deeper honesty, deeper openness. Like that I can be myself here. Mm-hmm. That I can be real and find acceptance with you. That I can climb into bed and feel enjoyment in being together without a sense of pressure or having to manage you, that we are better able to manage ourselves and cultivate real connection with each other in what we do. I hate to brag, but it's really my best course.
Well, you see that about every new course you develop, you just get better and better.
Well, I mean, that is the gift of writing a book, is it just pushes you to really think about these things,
right,
and really kind of get more clear about what actually helps people shift, what helps people change,
yes,
what is it that people are looking for. Uh-huh. And so, you know, so it's really there to help support people. A lot of people read the book and be like, I want this. I need more support in creating it. And so the course is that.
Great. Well, Jennifer, mm-hmm. thank you for sharing your gifts with the world. And
thank you
for your courage to step into your best self and to share what you're learning and just your expertise. You've blessed our marriage. You've blessed millions of people, I'm sure, mm-hmm. through generations.
Thank you.
With your work.
Well, it's my deep privilege, so thank you.
If people aren't familiar with you, where can they go to learn more about you?
Well, my website, which is finlayson-fife.com, and on there you can find a free podcast, a podcast where I work with real couples, the courses, it's all there. So
very good.
Book. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.